What do you guys do when you just want to read something for fun and relaxation? And then we looked over and said, well, that's what we're doing. This is what we read. We want to relax and have fun. So, well, now I understand why they put you guys in the back row. So, but now I will share about one event that we did at Ohio State University. The kind of the main event we did there was a forum on creation, evolution, intelligent design, our biblical, our testable creation model. And this is something we've now done three times on major university campuses. And the format is that I will speak for 25 minutes outlining our testable creation model from the standpoint of the simple sciences of math, astronomy, physics, and geophysics. Then Fuzz gets up and does the complex sciences, also speaking for 25 minutes, looking at biochemistry, biology, and anthropology. And then we invite the leading science faculty on the campus who come from either an agnostic or an atheistic perspective to respond. And in this particular event, we had three respondents, and then we were allowed just a few minutes to respond to their responses, and then the audience comes. But because we're facing the most well-known atheist professors on the campus, we always draw packed out crowds. In fact, even when they charge money, it's packed out. So although usually what we do is to say, if you're going to charge money, you can charge for everybody that's not a student, but students come in for free. And what they've noticed is that actually draws a bigger crowd of students. Students figure if it's worth something, then they'll go to it. But all three of them we've done have I've drawn over 1,000 people. It all depends on what the seating capacity is. And so like the other events, let's see, at UC Davis, we had 1,300 show up. That was, the seating capacity was 1,200, but we had 1,300. And we did at the University of Illinois, we had 1,700 show up. And again, that was the auditorium filled the capacity. The auditorium we were in this time could only seat 1,000. And we had about 1,100 people jammed into the auditorium. So it is getting the gospel out to people that otherwise wouldn't hear it. I can tell you it's extremely challenging to present in 25 minutes a testable scientific model for creation that can withstand the assaults of the atheists that are there. And we keep pressing to get a little more time, saying, you know, it's really, you really can't do justice to a scientifically testable model in just 25 minutes. But the atheists always want to have their time, so we kind of have to split it with them. And then we try to do is give them our books, so at least they can see some of our testable model in the book. And they really appreciate that, by the way, that we're willing to give them all of our material so they can study it and come up with a critique. What made this event particularly interesting is just a week before we showed up, there was in both Nature and Science, and Nature and Science are the two leading science journals in the industry, and Nature, for example, I don't have the magazine with me, but their cover article was Intelligent Design Coming to a Community Near You, and was emblazoned on the cover. And then they had an editorial inside on how to deal with design when it comes to your campus, and then a long article that featured design inside. And Science Magazine did the same thing. But the thing I noted is that in both of these articles, there's this perception that if you look at science from a Christian perspective, it stultifies science. Just to give you a quote from this Nature editorial, it says, when more conservative religious groups try to halt the teaching of scientific theories in schools and universities. So the perception is, if you're coming from a Christian perspective, your goal is to halt the advance of science education and scientific research. And we certainly saw that coming back to us from the participants that were in this mini debate. But there's also something here where in the editorial they're encouraging scientists not to debate Christians on the campus. Quote here, a formal debate is not how we do science. And then a quote here from a University of Oklahoma professor, we will not agree to debate the creationists publicly. And what I discovered is they really had quite a difficult time getting people to oppose us. What they really want to do is get Lawrence Krauss. He's not from Ohio State. He's at Case Western Reserve University. But he is the leading anti-intelligent design spokesman, if not in the state of Ohio, perhaps even in the United States. He's on television all the time, and yet he refused to respond to my talk. And based on this thing is that we're not going to debate these people. We're not going to even give any legitimacy to what they're saying. On the other hand, we found that there were faculty at Ohio State that were quite willing to do it. And what really threw us is that there was one pastor in the state of Ohio that insisted that he'd be on the program to oppose us. And it's a guy I know. I've known him for about 20 years. It's George Murphy. And George Murphy is a Lutheran pastor and active in both the Episcopalian and Evangelical Lutheran Church of America denominations. Although the word evangelical, I don't think, no longer applies to that denomination. And he's also a theoretical physicist and kind of sees himself as a science faith spokesman for the Christian community, but takes quite a different perspective than what we do. But he absolutely insisted, even though he wasn't part of the campus, that he'd be part of this, so they let him come in. And I thought it'd be good just to share with you what he said in his message. And I'm just going to ask you flat out how you would deal with this, because it's not just on Ohio State campus that you're going to find it. But when he got his 10 minutes worth to respond to us, what he did is he quoted several verses out of the Bible that make the point that God is a being that hides himself. And his conclusion is that God is hidden in his revelation. God is revealed in Christ, he said, not in nature. He quoted a verse from Isaiah, you are a God who hides himself. And he had a couple of the verses he quoted. And then he says, God acts through the rational processes of nature. And then he said, for us to look for God in nature is actually a sin, because he quoted a verse out of the New Testament where Jesus was performing miracles, and the Pharisees and Sadducees came up to him and said, we want to see another one. And he said, you should not ask God for a sign. So basically he said what Dr. Ross and Dr. Rana are doing are demanding from God a sign. That's not what Christianity is all about. And his main point was this, that God reveals himself through the person of Jesus Christ, through the incarnation, and that any attempt to claim that God reveals himself through nature is to diminish the impact of the incarnation. We should look at the incarnation, only the incarnation, for a revelation from God. Well, I came up with a response. But what I'm going to do is put all of you on the spot and say, you know, if you were faced with that, what kind of response would you come up with? Romans 1, okay. That's a very good place to start. Romans 1, 18 through to about 23, which makes the point that we are all without excuse, because God has revealed himself faithfully through the record of nature, not just his mere existence, but his attributes and his power are revealed through that. So, and you know, Fuzz made a comment when this gentleman came up and said, well, he thought this was a narrow view of Revelation. And of course, there's more than just Romans 1 you could quote. What did you have? Right. The heavens declare the glory of God. God's words are written upon the heavens for everyone to read. That's Psalm 19, 1 through 4. Psalm 50, verse 6, and 97, verse 6. The heavens declare the righteousness of God. So it's not just the fact that God reveals himself through nature. What he's all about is also revealed through the record of nature. Yes. Right. Very good point. And why are they hidden? Let me just pick up the verse. You know, whenever anyone throws a verse out that, quote, refutes you, it's always good to look at the context. And it says, you are a God who hides himself. He left off the second half of the verse. You know what the second half of the verse says? You are a God who hides himself, but a wise man seeks him out. Okay. Okay. You can always make the point you want to make by just clipping the right part of the verse. And actually what I think is particularly helpful, here's a question I'm going to pose to you. There's actually quite a few places in the Bible where it talks about the hiddenness of God. I think you're making the point. You know, he doesn't come and reveal himself like a man. What would you discover if you were to actually look up every verse in the Bible that talks about God hiding himself or the hiddenness of God? What would you discover? Any clue? In what way? Okay, you're getting close to the point. God is hidden to a particular segment of the population. And God is revealed to another segment of the population. Any clues? I mean, it's really interesting to look at these passages and see what it really says as to why God is hidden. Okay. All right, what is your theory? So if he was so blatant that we couldn't possibly deny his reality, right? Okay. But interestingly, in the millennium, he will be revealed in that fashion, and even then, he'll still be hidden to certain people. Even though he's walking around right in front of us, even though he's on television every night, people will still claim not to know him. Okay, now, well, you know, once we're finished with the book of Job, we're going to be going to the Psalms. And the Psalms is where you really see all these passages about God hiding himself. And Mel is right on target. God hides himself to those who are proud before the Lord. Those are the ones who are not going to find him. You know, God gives grace to the humble, but he resists the proud. And as we go into these passages in the Psalms, you're going to see that. And when God talks about the fact that he is hidden, he is hidden from the man or the woman who resists his authority. But for the one who is willing to submit to his authority, he is abundantly revealed. So this is what George Murphy was missing, is that all this stuff about God being hidden and not discoverable is in the context of people who are desiring to walk away from God rather than to seek him out. In fact, there's one beautiful verse that we'll be studying about how anyone who seeks God will find him. And one of the ways they find him is through the record of nature. For what it's worth, no one in the audience at Ohio State was sucked in by George Murphy's appeal that God is hidden, or that, you know, only the revelation of God in the incarnation is something that we should condone as a revelation of God. Yes. Yeah. Well, my response was simply, because, you know, he was quoting selectively from the Bible about God's hiddenness. And I said, well, you know, our appeal here tonight is that to build a biblical model, you have to look at all the creation texts, not just here and there, and integrate it together. And when you do, you discover that there are many places in the Bible where God's revelation through nature is explicitly declared. And so I kind of did what those of you in the class have done. Psalm 50, verse 6, Psalm 97, verse 6, Psalm 19, 1 through 4, Romans chapter 1, Colossians chapter 2, verse 9, I mean, passages like that. And I just quoted a few, because I was really thinking more about the audience. I knew I wasn't going to convince George. I'd dealt with him in the past. But my whole reason was to assure the audience that there was scripture here to deal with that. So that was our basic response. And then, you know, Fuzz came in and made the comment that, you know, it's typical when reading portions of scripture to only pick a part of God's revelation. And then what George Murphy was doing was giving a very limited perspective on revelation. We tried to build bridges in the sense that he says we fully agree that Christ is revealed, or that God is revealed in the incarnation. And we also would agree that that's the greatest revelation of God to us. So, you know, we tried to say, yeah, I mean, you've got a good point there. That is, that it's not the only revelation that God has given to us. And how would you deal with the Old Testament saints if everything was only in the revelation of Christ in the incarnation? And what would Moses do? What would Job do if the only way God revealed himself was through the incarnation? So I think that worked well with the audience. We decided not to push too hard as taking the verses out of context. because then you're beginning to attack his character, and we didn't want to do that. So, and I knew what George was really up to. What George is really up to is building what I would call a bulletproof apologetic, trying to establish an argument for the Christian faith that could not be assaulted by any possible scientific discovery. Now, the price you pay for wearing a bulletproof vest in apologetics is that if there's no possibility that you will lose, there's also no possibility that you will win. You know, what evidence can you give from science, from your Christian faith, if you're trying to claim that there's no scientific evidence that could ever refute your Christianity? I think it was most interesting, this has happened at all three of these campus events we've done, is someone in the audience inevitably asks us, okay, well, what kind of scientific discovery would disprove your creation model? And it's interesting that people really aren't listening, because, you know, here we're speaking for 50 minutes with our PowerPoint presentations, and I usually give about a dozen examples of how our model can be put to the test and predictions that we're making about what science could discover in the future that could prove our model wrong or prove our model right. And it doesn't matter. Every time we do that, the atheist scientists get up and say, there are no predictions in this model. And I said, you know, have you been listening? We just gave you about 25, and we could give you a lot more. I mean, you've got our books. Our books give way more than that. But it's mainly their approach. As Fuzz has commented, every time we've done this, the atheist professors never refute our science. We never hear a complaint about the science we're putting forward. What they try to do every single time is to change the rules of the game and say that what they do is they redefine science in such a narrow fashion that what we're presenting would no longer qualify as science, rather than actually dealing with the model that we're presenting, the predictions we're putting out. They just try to say, well, like one common response is say, well, science is only about repeatable experiments, and you can't do the repeat of the experiment of creation, therefore it's not science. Well, that would eliminate the entire disciplines of paleontology, astronomy, and anthropology. Now, those are scientific disciplines where you can't repeat the experiments, but you infer it from evidence from the record of nature. And interestingly, when we were at UC Davis, that comment came from a theoretical physicist. And I said, well, I mean, the whole discipline of theoretical physics would be gone. So I said, I didn't say anything to him publicly, but afterwards, you know, as we were talking privately, I said, well, are you concerned about funding for your research? Because you've just defined science in such a way that you're no longer in the scientific enterprise. And he said, well, I get your point. So, well, the thing I've noticed is that, because that's a key part of my message, is the evidence from the Big Bang for a transcendent creator who exquisitely fine-tuned the universe. Every single time, they ignore my message. They will not deal with the content. This happens to Fuzz, too. He talks about the origin of life and the origin of humanity. They basically ignore what they're talking about. And, like, the only scientific critique I've ever heard is at the University of Illinois. And what the professor did is he pulled a statement completely out of context of this book and claimed that it wasn't true, knowing full well we would not have time for a rebuttal. Because the guy that followed him, instead of sticking to his 10 minutes, spoke for 45 minutes. And so they had to get rid of our rebuttal time. And I was just itching to respond to his out-of-context statement. But, yeah, I've never heard them respond to the Big Bang stuff. Well, the other thing I've noted is that I've yet to hear any of these scientists try to argue scientific evidence for their atheistic or agnostic worldview. What they've done every single time is go into a philosophy of science type of discussion. And what they prefer to do is rather than attack or critique what we presented, and this happened at Ohio State University, the physicist got up and spent his entire time attacking intelligent design. And we made it really clear, look, we're not presenting an intelligent design perspective, we're presenting a testable, falsifiable, predictive creation model. And so we had to remind the audience, look, we're not doing what the ID people are doing, refusing to identify the creator or refusing to take a position on descent with modification or the age of the universe. We're doing none of that. And that's why our model is testable and their model is not. But, you know, again, it's a straw man. Rather than responding, they were given specific instructions. Because we're giving you our books so that you can go through them and you can respond to the 25-minute message or you can respond to the material in the books. But we've yet to have them actually do that kind of response. They instead get off onto a philosophy of science. Now, as I've talked to Fuzz about this, he says, well, look, if I was in their shoes, I would do the same thing. You know you're not going to win in the scientific evidence. Therefore, what you need to do is shift the whole discussion into philosophy. And it's something I've told this audience before, is that you know the tide has turned when the skeptic starts talking philosophy instead of talking science. When the rebuttals are philosophical, then that's basically they're conceding the point that the scientific evidence does not support their model, supports our model. And so they go into the philosophy of science. And I would agree with Fuzz. If I was in their shoes trying to push an atheistic worldview perspective, there's no way I'm going to touch the science unless I know I'm dealing with Christians who are presenting bogus science, which is why they'd much rather be facing the younger creationists or the intelligent design people, because then they can go after the bad science. Yeah. Well, essentially, when I had my chance, I did make the point, look, we're not talking ID. And then just try to remind them, because they kept saying, we've heard nothing tonight that is predictive. And I just had to remind them, look, that's what you've been hearing. And I just repeat the predictions that we gave. I mean, we had them all bulleted up on, you know, the whole thing. 6 predictions on the origin of the universe. You know, 10 predictions on the design of the universe. And we showed them where our predictions had come true. And then we said, we're sticking our neck out. We're making predictions for the future. But, you know, they just basically raise up that straw man and say, ID. And say, but we're not talking that. So, I mean, I'll give you an example. Mark Pinnanol was the cosmologist that was supposed to respond to me, and his comment was the scientific method is not a religious tool. He should have figured out where the scientific method came from, but he didn't do that. Science explains the how and not the why. The why cannot be tested. And then scientific theories must be testable, falsifiable, and predictive. It must open up new questions. Miracles are not testable, and a Christian worldview perspective shuts down investigation by appealing to the God of the gap. And there are no contrasting predictions, and which is amazing, because that's exactly what I did in my message, is say, if you're coming from a non-theistic perspective, this is what you would predict. Coming from our perspective, this is what you predict. So, but, you know, my response to that was, again, to remind him and the audience where the scientific method came from. It came from the pages of the Bible, not from any other source. And that good science must not limit itself to just the how. Any good scientific model, and I gave some examples, must address the how and the why. If you don't address the why, you're not going to be able to give a good answer to the how. But likewise, theology is the same. Theology, because that was his point, theology focuses on the why, science focuses on the how. And I said, that's bad theology if all you do is focus on the why. Good theology must do both, and you can't give an adequate answer for the how or the why unless you do both. But just to give him some examples on both sides of the fence of how that works. But what this is really coming from is the work of Stephen Gould. Stephen Gould is the one 20 years ago who said, we can settle creation-evolution debates through separate magisteria, which means we have over here the magisterium of religion, and over here we have the magisterium of science. Then he went on to say, science is based on fact and reason, and religion is based on wishful thinking. It wasn't quite that bold. What he said is, religion is based on emotions and ethics, whereas science is based on reason and fact. Therefore, they're mutually exclusive. We don't have to fight because one deals with the emotions and the ethics and the why. The other deals with facts and reasons and the how. But I'm writing a response to this. I have written some already, but it's going in my next book. making the point that rather than science and religion being separate magisteria, they completely overlap. There's no way you can do science without getting into religious perspectives. I had a chance to say some about that at this event. Yeah. What was interesting is that lunch hour. I did a faculty luncheon, and they were expecting maybe 80 to show up for the faculty luncheon. We had 110, so really good representation from the faculty of Ohio State University. And kind of knowing that this was going to happen in the evening, and I've done this at every place, because that's one thing we get to do. We get to address the faculty first, then we have the big evening forum. But my faculty message was science and Genesis, is there a problem? And kind of laid out for them at the very beginning of that message, what are the roots of the scientific method? And, first of all, bring out all the places in the Bible where it makes the point that everything must be tested. Don't believe until you first put to the test. 1 Thessalonians 5:21, everything must be tested. Hold fast to that which is good. You see that repeated again in Malachi and other places of the Old Testament. And then just gave them some examples of, what's the whole point of the scientific method? The point of the scientific method is to slow human investigators from forming an interpretation too quickly. And it's based on the biblical principle that we have a fallen nature, and we're too quick to come to conclusions, and therefore God has given us this testing method. And how, just taking through Genesis 1, it says, look at Genesis 1, and doesn't the scientific method just jump right off the page? And isn't it interesting that God does this on the very first page of his revelation, his written revelation? How there's this frame of reference stated first, and the point of view second. The frame of reference and the point of view, the initial conditions, and then you go through the six creation days, and it basically tells you what's happening, when it's happening, where, what order. There's a statement of what the thing looked like, that looked like to the end, the final conditions. Then you draw an interpretation. Those are the first five steps of the scientific method, all laid out beautifully in Genesis chapter 1. And then it said, then what's the sixth step? You test your initial interpretation that you've not invested a lot of emotions in by looking at other texts, other experiments, other observations. And I just asked a question to all the faculty there. How many creation accounts are there in this book? And they came up with all kinds of answers. Most of them said one. A couple of them said, oh no, there's two. And I said, well, there's more than 20. And I said, how many do you find in the other holy books? It's either zero or one. The one that has the most outside the Bible, the Quran, it's got three. Although two of them are plagiarized right from the Bible. So there's only one that's original to the Quran. And that one contradicts the other two. So... in that sense, we need to realize, like the Mormon faith, too, has a couple of creation accounts. But so you need to understand, Mormonism and Islam are Christian cults. And they build on the Old and New Testament, and then they add their own revelation, which contradicts what you see in the Old and the New Testament. The whole point is there's these different creation accounts. And kind of what I did during the luncheon is I took them through Genesis 1 using the scientific method that you get from the scriptures. And then I said, let's put this to the test by looking at other creation accounts. Because, okay, here's this interpretation. And I said, let me point out the most controversial parts of this interpretation. And I said, let's look at the other creation accounts and see if we can get rid of the controversy. So kind of just showing them up front exactly how this works from a biblical perspective. And one of the sponsors there, one of the Christian faculty, she's heard me speak many times over the past 20 years. She came up to me afterwards and said, because she asked me to give this talk. I wasn't planning to give that talk to the faculty, but she asked me to give the talk. And because she says, the faculty at Ohio State University who are Christians are extremely divided on creation theology. And I heard they had younger creationists, they had framework hypothesis people, gap theorists. And she says, about 25 of those 110 faculty were Christians. And she said, you should see their Christian faculty meeting. a fight breaks out every time they open up their lunch bag. But her comment was that that was the most disarming talk she ever heard me give, because nobody was disputing it afterwards, just simply taking me through all those creation accounts. But that really helped me in the evening event, because I could refer back to what I had done, and it was recorded. So you can get the recording of the lecture I gave to the faculty. And I really liked that, because I said 25 minutes is incredibly challenging to get any significant points across. But just to be able to say, look, there's an hour-long message that's been recorded, and I've been able to use that in all three of these venues. So, but the funny thing was, George Murphy, of course, came in all of his clerical garb, you know, his black gown and his little clerical collar. And, well, he always does that. I've known him a long time. But, yeah, one guy came to the microphone and says, how come the guy in the clerical garb seems to believe a whole lot less in God and the Bible than these gentlemen over here? So, but his real motivation is to build a bulletproof apologetic. But when you build a bulletproof apologetic, you basically strip yourselves of any tools of trying to persuade non-Christians that the Christian faith is incorrect. And yet some of you asked me for some examples, and that's what happened from the audience. It says, give us some examples of discoveries that could disprove your Christianity. So I said, okay, if scientists were ever to show in a convincing way that the universe had no beginning, if they were to show that there was no causal agent responsible for the beginning of the universe, I can't see how the Christian faith would survive. I mean, that's one of the foundations of a Christian theology, is that there is a causal agent that creates the universe, that actually creates space and time. So if we were to show that that was a false concept, that would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. And then Fuzz volunteered the one about human origins. If we were to show that the human species is no different than all the other species of life on the planet, that we really don't have a spirit nature distinct from what the other animals have, or that we're not descended from a single couple, that's relatively recent in the past. That, too, would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. Jesus built many of his sermons on that concept. But what we were hoping to do, and we've had a chance to do this in all three venues, okay, we've revealed some discoveries that would be fatal to our worldview. How about some discoveries that would be fatal to your worldview? They're never forthcoming. So what we do is actually give some examples for them. But what's been encouraging for us is, well, yeah, I mean, they're never forthcoming. But, you know, they always say, we demand that you give us some discoveries that would be fatal to your Christian faith. I figure, okay, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Why don't you come up with some? But they never do. And so with Fuzz and I, we actually build it into our talk. We say, these are discoveries that would demonstrate that a non-theistic perspective on the universe is incorrect if these discoveries were made. And a real easy one is this. That's the one we kind of hammered in all three things. If we're wrong, then as astronomers learn more about the universe, all this evidence we see for design will find natural explanations for them. And the evidence for design will shrink. There'll be fewer characteristics revealing design, and the amount of fine-tuning will not be as impressive. And we'll see a growing progression. So you don't have to wait long. Within 6 weeks, if the Christian perspective is incorrect, we should see significant erosion on the evidence for fine-tuning. On the other hand, if the Christian faith is correct, we would expect that in the next 6 weeks there would be significant improvement in the fine-tuning argument for the existence of the God of the Bible. So I said, no need to fight, let's wait 6 weeks. But I'll tell you, the other side never picks up on it. And so we kind of have to repeat that again for the benefit of the audience. Yeah. It's not possible that the universe is finely tuned and we're in it. And in between my lecture, I wasn't going to talk about my other lectures, but in between my lecture to the faculty and my lecture, the big forum lecture in the evening, 4:30 p.m., I got to give a lecture to the physics department. And what was interesting there is the faculty refused to sponsor it, the physics faculty. They said, oh, no, this is religious. We can't sponsor this. We can't do this. Well, like when I was going through school, the physics graduate students have their own organization. And so the physics graduate student union said, we'll sponsor it. If the faculty is not willing to practice academic freedom, we are. So they sponsored it. And it was unbelievable. I mean, we were in a room that held 80 people. There were 150 jammed in there. And there were people all standing around the door trying to listen in. And we had a lot of faculty there. And they come up afterwards and says, we missed the boat. We should have sponsored this thing. We're not going to let this happen again. You guys come back to the campus, we'll make this an official academic colloquium. So that'll be fun. But what happened during that colloquium is that question got posed. And so I gave that as an example of how the rebuttals against God as the creator of the universe are philosophical in nature and not scientific. And I said, that rebuttal is a philosophical rebuttal. And then, of course, I made a joke saying that we have a philosopher on our staff that's full-time. But Fuzz and I always kid Ken Samples by saying that the only value philosophers serve is to help you win arguments against other philosophers. It's true. There's nothing that they do that's of any value except that. But that's an important job for someone to take. You need someone out there. And that particular rebuttal was responded to by Richard Swinburne about 20 years ago. Richard Swinburne is one of Britain's most famous philosophers. And he's not evangelical, but he is a theist. And what Richard Swinburne pointed out is that this comment, well, of course the universe has these characteristics, because he wouldn't be here to observe it if it did not. No big deal about this. He says, yes, it is a big deal. And the analogy he came up with, I think I described it here in The Creator and the Cosmos, is he said, think of a firing squad. And think of a person about to be executed by a firing squad. You know how it works. They blindfold some guy, put him up against the wall, and then they have a bunch of people with rifles about 15 to 20 feet back, and they all point their sights at the guy, and they pull the trigger, and the guy dies. They said, you know, what if that were to happen and the guy survived? And he takes the blindfold off and says, well, of course, I wouldn't be here to observe all of you unless they all miss. And his comment is, you're asking the wrong question. That's the wrong response, to say they all miss. What really would be in the back of the mind of a person who survived the firing squad execution is to say, why did they miss? There's got to be some reason or purpose for them missing. They couldn't have missed by sheer chance. I mean, their rifles are just simply too close. There's too many of them. And you don't pick guys that are bad shots for a firing squad. A bunch of blind guys up there. Now, the whole idea of a firing squad execution is you want every bullet to go through the heart of that person that's being executed. That way, nobody knows, you know, which bullet really did the guy in. They're all going to do him in. So you want good sharpshooters, and that's the whole point. But he says the only thing that makes rational sense for that survivor is to say they must have purposed that I would survive, or somebody put blanks in their gun. Someone out there purposed that I would survive. Likewise, what Richard Swinburne says, we look at these fine-tuned characteristics of the universe, and the only rational philosophical conclusion to draw is that those characteristics are fine-tuned to that degree because there's someone out there that purposed that we human beings would be alive at this point in time in cosmic history. So, for that reason, that argument hardly ever comes up anymore. Richard Swinburne is so famous that virtually every physicist has heard of it. But there were a couple of graduate students there who hadn't heard of it, so we got to go over that again. Also, we dealt with the multiverse, and then the one from Hawking, Stephen Hawking, who says, well, if it's the God of the Bible, he doesn't waste miracles. He's not going to make 100 billion trillion useless stars. That was already in my talk. Why there's got to be that many stars, no more, no less. In fact, you've got to fine-tune the total mass of stars to within one part in 10 to the 60th, or there's going to be no possibility for planet Earth. And I was joking with Fuzz about this because, you know, the biologists got up to speak. And where have I got the biologist comment? And I said, Fuzz, this is two for two. Both at the University of Illinois and Ohio State University, the biologists that got up to respond to Fuzz basically didn't say anything. And they asked for Fuzz's response, and Fuzz says, I have no comments. She basically spent her time, and, you know, she was a famous biologist there. And I figured, well, she'd make better use of her time than this. But she talked about the creation myth. And then she talked about this mission that NASA has to go to a comet and recover stuff from a comet. And then the rest of it was just stream of consciousness. I mean, nobody could tell where she was going or why she was going in her message. But she was really quite impressed with what she said. Big smile on her face and sat down. She told some really amusing stories, and Fuzz complimented her for her amusing stories. And so they said, well, the biochemist has no comment. Does the astronomer have any comment? I figured, well, what am I going to talk about and all this stuff? But I did pick up on her creation myth saying, you know, simply ridiculing the stories of primitive cultures, the Indians and the Eskimos and, the Vikings, etc., really doesn't address the challenge that the Bible gives as a creation account that's completely compatible with Scripture. You know, the whole idea that the oceans are there because the first woman urinated just isn't, that's the kind of stuff she was talking about. And, how there was these gods that fought one another and they struck one another with swords and the blood that was spilt, that became the earth, that became life and humans, etc. And I said, well, I mean, we call these myths for a good reason, but that doesn't mean that every story of creation is a myth. But as an astronomer, I felt it was important to comment on the thing about this rocket. Now, what I found interesting, she talked about this rocket that NASA's going to send to this comet and grab a sample of the comet, but she never explained why this was part of her rebuttal to her talk. So I said, let me explain to you what I think she wanted to say. And she was very grateful for the way I said it. She said, yeah, that's what I meant. I said, what she's really talking about is getting a sample, and maybe they're going to find in that sample proteins, and they're going to find DNA and RNA. And, somewhere there in outer space is this incubator that makes all these very complex molecules for life. Or if they don't find that, maybe they're going to find amino acids and 5 and 6 carbon sugars and nucleotides, and possibly they could be built up. He said, yeah, that's what I meant. And I said, well, one sense we already know, because we astronomers have been taking detailed spectra of interstellar gas, and comets are simply concentrated interstellar gas. And I said, yeah, you're right. We have found some amazing carbonaceous molecules in that interstellar gas, 122 at last count. I said, what's also interesting, and this is where it helps to be up on the latest literature. I said, just 4 weeks ago, radio astronomers withdrew the claim that they had found glycine in interstellar in nebulae. Glycine is the simplest of the amino acids. And above of the sugars, the nucleotides, and the amino acids, the simplest molecule of all is glycine in that whole category. And I said they had to withdraw the claim. They now realize that it was a false detection, and they misidentified the spectral line. So, yeah, here we've been looking for 40 years for complex molecules in the interstellar medium, and we found 122 of them, but no sugars. We have found no nucleotides and no amino acids. And so we already know we're going to find, we go to that thing. And I said, you can make that a prediction. I'll predict that they won't find any proteins, DNA, and RNA. You can make the prediction that they will. Then we're going to know within a year or two. And I said, let's just, see who's right and who's wrong. So, answer to the challenge from the physicists that a Christian worldview perspective stultifies science. And his whole point was Dr. Mark Pisanol, that if you're a Christian, you're always appealing to the God of the gap. If we don't understand something, that's because God did it. And that stultifies science if you don't bother to go look. And Fuzz's response is, well, it's actually the other way around. And the example he gave was junk DNA. And says, we've known about this junk DNA for 30 years, but for a 20-year period, there wasn't any research going on this junk DNA because the assumption was it's junk. But so from a Christian perspective, we would realize that God creates with purpose, and was actually a bunch of physicists that discovered that there was something in that junk DNA that didn't look like junk. And the physicists found it, then the biologists started looking for purpose in the DNA. So it says, you know, it was this non-Christian perspective that stopped the halt of research on the structure of junk DNA. You know, it makes up 90% of the genomes of all life. Most of it is in the category of what they call non-coding DNA, DNA that doesn't code for proteins. And I said, you know, it's physicists who weren't quite as locked in to an atheistic worldview as a biologist. And by the way, it's by and large true that physicists are much more willing to consider a theistic perspective than the biologists are. And you know, here was this paper published, I think it was in Physics Review Letters, 1994. And this group of physicists looked at this junk DNA and analyzed it with a computer program for grammatical structure. And what they discovered is that there was more linguistic complexity in the junk than there was the coding part of the DNA. And then they concluded, it said there must be some hidden purpose in all this junk DNA. So it got published in the physics journal that day. It didn't, and it took the biologists and they say, well, I guess there must be something here. Yeah. You know, I don't know, it was a rather large team, so chances are some were. But when that paper was published, everybody was asking the question, how come this wasn't published in a biology journal? It got published, you know, Physics Review Letters is usually for theoretical physics. And, but, you know, it got published there. And all the people who did the work were physicists, not biologists. And so here's this 20-year period where biological research basically came to a halt. And it came to the halt just because it said, well, we all know there is no God. There is no God. We would expect lots of junk to accumulate in the genomes of all life. There's no purpose here. It's not worth studying. And it literally set the whole field back by 20 years. And the whole point is there's many examples you can give like that. I could give examples in astronomy, research for extraterrestrial intelligent life. A lot of money, a lot of time being wasted because people are going at it with a wrong worldview perspective. So, and by the way, you've got the no God of the gaps argument too. What I see is atheists constantly saying, oh, we got a gap here, we don't understand things. And then they use the non-existence of God to explain that gap, rather than what we really should do is say, let's test no God versus God and see which one proves to be correct. Or the real sign of that appeal is an origin of life research. And, you know, one of the talks I got to give there was on the origin of life. Fuzz got to give one too. But what you notice in origin of life research is they recognize all these intractable problems of trying to explain the origin of life from a non-theistic perspective. You know what their appeal is? They used to say it was intelligent aliens that brought life here. They now realize that isn't going to go anywhere because it just pushes the question one step back. Where did the aliens come from? What they're now claiming is that there's a law of physics that we can't see, that we can't discover, that creates life spontaneously everywhere in the universe. In fact, I'm not going to have time to talk about this because I want to talk a little bit about what we got here in the Book of Job. But next week I'll mention an article in this astrobiology journal. And it's published by two of the world's leading astrobiologists, Paul Davies and Charles Lineweaver. And their argument is that there must have been many origins of life on planet Earth because we know it's really easy. Why do we know it's really easy? Because life appeared on planet Earth without benefit of a prebiotic suit in a geological instant. Since it happened in a geological instant without benefit of a prebiotic suit, it must be extremely easy. Given that it's extremely easy, this must have happened hundreds of times over the history of the Earth. It should be happening today. It's got to be happening on Mars and Europa and Venus and all these other places. So I'll mention this next week. I haven't got time to go into it today, but that's a perfect example of a wrong worldview perspective. And basically what they're appealing to is this hidden law of physics. Well, it's kind of like what George Murphy is saying. God hides himself. Now he's saying physics hides itself. And, you know, how could this law, if it's that potent, ever remain hidden through all this scientific research? And actually, it's the law that violates the second law of thermodynamics. It's been called the fourth law of thermodynamics. And in essence, it's actually an anti-second law, a law that contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. But we have lots of evidence that isn't the case. Hey, let me get a little bit through here in the book of Job. We're finishing up here in Job 39, and the last creatures. What's interesting about Job 39, it's going into a set of birds and mammals that play a particular role in launching human civilization. It starts with goats, talks about deer, then donkeys, cows, ostriches, horses, hawks, eagles. And in chapter 40 and 41, we look at the behemoth and the leviathan. And in chapter 42, we're looking at human beings. Now, I actually taught a little bit about this in a church when I was back east. And one of the questions I got, I was wondering how come I never got the question here in the class. Question number one was, is this the order in which these creatures were domesticated by humans? It's possible. We do know that goats were the first creatures to be domesticated by humans. But whether it actually follows this specific order, goats, deer, donkeys, cows, ostriches, horses, hawks, and eagles, I don't know. Maybe someone here in the class knows, but I don't know. But it seems to me that that's probably roughly correct. But I see nothing in the text that tries to sequence these creatures in any particular order. I do see it as a set of creatures that are the most important in launching human civilization. And we've been talking about how each plays a specific role. But then another question that we got into, actually in some discussion after my message there, is it possible that this is ordered in terms of tameability? That might have some merit too. Goats, as I mentioned, are very easy to tame, and the deer are almost as easy to tame. And you got the donkeys, the cows, the ostriches, the horses. Hawks and eagles are much more difficult to tame than cows and donkeys, so there's some point there. And then the behemoth. We're going to be, you know, we've talked about this before, but the behemoth, I believe, is a hippopotamus. And a hippopotamus is very difficult to tame. Okay? You think, right? Well, people have tamed hippos, but you basically got to get the hippo from the point they're born. And then just give them lots of human contact from that point onwards. So there's some zoos around here that do have tamed hippos. The leviathan, I believe, refers to the crocodile. And a crocodile is even more difficult to tame than the hippo. Not impossible, but probably of all the creatures we can think of that would take on the soulish perspective, it would be the most difficult. And then I find what's really interesting, what's the hardest creature of all to tame? A human being. Okay? And maybe there is some reason for God ordering it this way. Well, I mean, there's a reference in James about, you know, we've tamed all kinds of creatures. But what's the most difficult thing to tame of all is the tongue, right? How difficult it is to tame the tongue. And it's difficult for any one of us to tame our own tongue, let alone someone else's tongue, okay? So it's possible that there actually is some intended order to this. But it's possible that that order is just a rough appearance that we see here in the text. But what I want to finish off here is the last two verses in Job 39, talking about these eagles and hawks. It says, from there he seeks out his food, this very high crag. His eyes detect it from afar. His young ones feast on blood, and where the slain are, there he is. And as many of you know, one of the great controversies on Christian theology, did God create animals in a carnivorous form before Adam and Eve had sinned against God? Some creationists believe that there was no carnivorous activity until Adam had rebelled against God, and all the creatures were herbivores until that point. But this is a passage where, you know, God is speaking to Job and his four friends, and speaking to them about what he has done in creation. So I don't see this as a reference to a time after the fall of man. The whole context of Job 38 and 39 is what God did when he created these creatures in the beginning. And here it makes a reference to these young ones feasting on blood, and where the slain are, there he is. And, you know, both eagles and the hawks are very quick to find a carrion. Any creature that has died, they go down there and they feed on the dead body. Now, it's not just Job 39 that makes this comment. We see it in Job 38, in verse 39, where God asks a question to Job. Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lion when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in the thicket? Who provides food for the raven when his young cry out to God and wander about for lack of food? So this is a reference to the fact that God is claiming to provide food for these carnivorous creatures. Not just vegetables, but actually providing prey for both the raven and the lioness that they feed upon. One of the creation accounts we're going to be looking at, in fact, it's probably the creation account we're going to go to right after we finish up here in the book of Job, is Psalm 33. It's a creation psalm. And as you go through Psalm 33, it again talks about what God has done when he created. I don't see it as a reference to what God did after the fall of Adam, rather what he did when he created him. It says, he is faithful in all he does. The earth is full of God's unfailing love. In other words, we can look out at the creation according to Psalm 33. As we look at that creation, we see the testimony of his love, and we're going to see that throughout the Psalms, the heavens declare not only the glory of God and the righteousness of God, but the love of God. He spoke and it came to be, commanded it stood firm. He watches over all who live on the earth to deliver them from death and to keep them alive in famine. So again, it's making a point here that God is providing food for all of his creatures. Genesis 1 makes the point that when God created land mammals to cohabit the planet with him, this is creation day 6, and this is in the context before God created Adam and Eve, that he created two kinds of land mammals, long-legged, four-footed land mammals, those that are easy to tame and those that are difficult to tame. Easy to tame, as we've already noted in Job 39, are the herbivores. The difficult to tame ones are the carnivores. And then Psalm 104 says, the earth is full of your creatures. There is the sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both large and small. And they all look to you at the proper time. When you give it to them, they all look to you to give them their food at the proper time. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open their hand, they are satisfied with good things. Verse 21, the lions roar for their prey and seek their food from God, making the point that they are receiving their prey from the hand of God. So these are a few places you can go in the Bible. Another one would be Matthew 6, where it talks about God feeding the birds of the air, both referring to the herbivorous birds and the carnivorous birds. These are places, Genesis 1, Matthew 6, Psalm 104, Psalm 33, Job 38, and Job 39. But I think it's well established the point that God is the one who's responsible for creating the carnivores. It's an expression of his love, and we human beings are the beneficiaries of God creating both herbivores and carnivores. What I want us to do next time, as we get into Job 40 and 41, if you've been with us a while, you'll remember that we actually spent some time in Job 40 and 41 before we went into Job 34 through to 39. And it's a highly controversial passage in terms of the Christian theology, but we spent some time looking at the behemoth and Leviathan. Now, this is interesting in the context that Job 39 is taking us from the physical creation to the soulless creation. Now, if you read the commentaries on the behemoth and Leviathan, what you'll notice is the older commentaries really struggle with the Leviathan. Then most of them would agree, as we've been talking about here, that it's referring to the hippopotamus and the crocodile, but why would the crocodile be classified as a soulless creature? Now, if you go into the Levitical law, you'll notice that there are verses in there, only a few, but there are three verses in the books of Leviticus and Numbers in Deuteronomy that refer to certain reptiles as being part of the soulless creatures. Not all, but some. And I've been watching National Geographic and PBS. You'll notice that there's new research that shows that the crocodile is an unusual reptile and that it cares for its young. You know, and that would be one of the biblical definitions or marks of soulishness. Does a creature actually show care and love for members of its own species? And for a long time, it was thought that the crocodiles were eating their young. They now realize that the mother crocodile actually rescues the newly hatched crocodiles to protect them from the carnivores in the area. And that the mother crocodile will fight fiercely to defend her baby. Now, that's not typical of most reptiles and amphibians, but this is an exception. And likewise, we do see reference to certain reptiles as being part of the nested creature. The whole point here is that in terms of classifying animals, don't be surprised that there's a slightly different classification system in the Bible than what you have in the disciplines of zoology. Yeah. And but the whole point is it actually does exhibit, unlike other reptiles, some of these soulish features, but not to the same degree as birds and mammals. And maybe that explains why it's so difficult to tame. And also, what does it feed on? It feeds on big stuff. So that makes it more challenging to tame again, the fact that we're considered part of its prey. So, makes it more challenging to tame. But I think the point still follows, especially when you get into this introduction. Job 40 goes on for 12 verses before it starts talking, actually 14 verses. Verses 1 through 14. Is an interlude between the close of Job 39 and the beginning of the discussion of the behemoth. Now, this seems out of place. Now, here's God talking about the physical creation of Job 38, the soulish creation of Job 39. Now he's going to talk to us about the behemoth and Leviathan, and last of all about human beings, but it throws in this little interlude of 14 verses. A question I got for you next week. Why is the interlude here? What's the point of this being in it? I believe it's all connected in terms of this creation sequence. So that's a problem you can puzzle over between now and next Sunday. What's with these 14 verses? Why do they seem like they don't fit, but they really do fit? And if you want the answer as to how they fit into this creation text, you really need to go back over the rest of the book of Job and look at the question, what were the big creation problems that these five men were discussing without too much success? What you really discover here is the Lord decides to address their big creation controversies. That's what I find encouraging. And the church has always argued over what the Bible says about creation. And I think we've got an example here. What the Lord does is he picks out their most controversial issue of all and says, I'm going to address it for your benefit. And therefore, I think there's some merit into doing kind of what I did at Ohio State University with the faculty, saying, I know these are the most controversial parts of what Genesis 1 is teaching. How can we directly deal with that and bring about resolution? I think that's what's happening here in these first 14 verses. But I don't want to take your joy of discovery away, okay? I expect when we all come back next week, you'll all have it all figured out. So with that, let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for all these puzzles and the problems that you stick on purpose into your biblical text. And Father, I pray that we would never ignore these problems that you place there, that we would realize trying to provoke us into thinking about things that we otherwise would not think about them. But Father, I ask that you would provoke each one of us between now and next Sunday. Drive us to this text and the rest of the book of Job, that we can discover things that you want us to learn and apply in our own lives, in our own ministry. In Jesus' name.